Parsha Power for Parshas Kisetse, and as I mentioned in the Parsha preview, I'm very excited for this particular Parsha Power because this one gives us the opportunity to dive into a huge Parsha filled with a lot of different mitzvos, and we get to kind of try to find the hidden structure behind the mitzvos and find the unifying themes, just like we did for Parshas Kedoshim and like we did for Parshas Mishpatim. And for Parshas Kisetse, which is the Parsha that contains the most mitzvos, 74 in all, so that mission becomes all the more important. And a couple of points just before we actually get into the Chabura. So Asi Kent shared with me Rav Soloveitchik's Parsha Shir from this week, and he sent me the recording. I listened to it, and he particularly sent it to me because of the Parsha-esque style that Rav Soloveitchik's Shir took, because he was going through a lot of the different mitzvos and the string that connects them, and it was very eye-opening for me, and it was enjoyable for me to listen to. But what was also particularly nice was that a lot of the themes that on my own that I identified in Parshas Kisetse, those were themes that Rav Soloveitchik saw as well. So Mirtz Hashem will talk about some of those. And for whoever is interested, or maybe I'll just anyway send Rav Soloveitchik's Shir along with my Parsha Power Chabura, I'll send Rav Soloveitchik's Shir for those who would like the opportunity to listen to that. Now, just in terms of Sefer Devarim at large. So just to review a little bit, Devarim, we said, was really the overview, and we have the bookend stories of that began the Gullus, going from leaving Har Sinai to the 40 years of wandering. But then Veschanan took us inside the Bris, and we went through the Aseres Dibros, and I mentioned that Veschanan had a particular focus on Ahava. Parshas Akev, which talked about Klal Yisrael's consequences of their actions and the historical significance of their actions. So Akev, we argued, had a focus on Yira. Now both Veschanan and Akev had the themes of Ahava and Yira, but Veschanan more focused on Ahava, Akev more focused on Yira. Parshas Re'eh, which was preparing for the New Covenant, talking about Har Ebal and Har Gerizim, so that was, we mentioned that Re'eh continued to develop the themes of Ahava and Yira. So when it came to Parshas Shoftim, which was last week's Parsha, which talked about a lot of the laws of the land, the institution of authority figures, and the series pertaining to war, so I want to suggest that all in all, Shoftim hones in on the Midah of Yira again. The people that we're supposed to have Yira for, the people that we are not supposed to have Yira for. And in terms of respect, in terms of awe. And when we turn over to Parshas Kisetse, which talks about a lot of the laws that would take place, or that would be relevant after war. So I want to suggest that Kisetse also, again, continues to develop the themes of Ahava and Yira. I want to suggest that Kisetse, the earlier half of Kisetse focuses on Ahava, and the latter half comes back to the theme of Yira. And this will actually answer one of the questions, the first question in the Parsha preview. In the Parsha preview, I posed a question, which is, why were the laws of Yifas Toar left alone in the beginning of Parshas Kisetse, and not stuck in Parshas Shoftim with all of the other laws relating to war? And when I go through the different topics, and in fact, actually, I'll answer this question right now. The first topic on Parshas Kisetse is the laws of Yifas Toar, which I'm the beautiful captive. There are two points that tell us why Yifas Toar is taking a new direction. The first point is that the war topics that were discussed in Parshas Shoftim, it starts off saying Kisetse al-Machama al-Evecha, and then it continues to talk about the war. But if you look at Parshas Kisetse, the Chumash actually tells us that the war is over. One second. In the beginning of Parshas Kiseitze, the Pasuk says, in its lashon, Kiseitze la melchama alaydecha, unesanu Hashem alokecha biyadecha v'shevis ha-shivyo. Hashem is going to give your enemies into your hand, i.e. the war is over, and then you'll have captives. Then it says, v'ra'isa ba-shivyo ha-esha sifas toar. You're going to see among the captives an esha sifas toar. Meaning the war is over. Kiseitze is picking up from the end of the war. And what happens at the end of the war? War is a time of yira. War is a time where we're typically thinking about the gvura aspect of our avoda, that we have to go in, we have to not be afraid of the other nation, but we have to inspire fear in the other nations. Our fear has to belong to Hashem alone. And that is what most of war is about. That is what authority figures are about, having shoftim and shotrim and nevi'im, listening to the right ones. That's where yira stands. Then Parshas Kiseitze begins and says, you are going to now be involved in ahava, meaning you have to know what ahava is going to be appropriate, what kind of ahava is going to be inappropriate, and that's exactly what happens with Yifas Toar. And as we'll see, it continues to weave its way through. The theme of ahava weaves its way through the earlier half of Kiseitze. One of the themes that Rav Soloveitchik identified, Rav Elio Soloveitchik, that is, of Lander, he identified the theme of the Jewish home, Jewish life, Jewish family, and we're going to talk a lot about that because a lot of that is relevant, and a lot of those themes I noticed in the Parsha as well. It starts from Yifas Toar. It starts from this understanding of what kind of ahava you're supposed to have, what kind of, and where ahava does not belong. And it does not belong in a place where it's all about the Yetzer Hara. And the love for the Yifas Toar is inspired just by the Yetzer Hara. Okay, so now just to talk about exactly what Kiseitze is, now that we understand the difference between Kiseitze and Shoftim. So again, Kiseitze is picking up at the end of the war. The laws for after the war, the emphasis is on building a home and the congregation of Yisrael. And as I suggested, the beginning at least, the focus is on Ahava, where Ahava is appropriate, where not, as opposed to Shoftim, which focused more on Yira, where and when Yira is appropriate and when it would be inappropriate. With that, let's go into the specifics of Parshas Kiseitze and try to find the mini themes in all of the mitzvos. And there are a bunch of different ways to divide them, and we tried it this way. Number one, I just referred to the section as dysfunctional family. All right, we have Yifas Toar, then we have the two wives, the Isha Ahuva, the Isha Snua, the beloved wife, the hated wife. Here again, we have the concept of Ahava. This is where we learn the rule of Pishnayim, that there's a double portion that belongs to the Bechor, the firstborn, and you can't pick and choose your firstborn. No, if it's the wife that you love, then she's going to be the one who has the firstborn. It doesn't work that way. It goes by biology, and it goes by timing. Whoever was literally the firstborn, and of course the follow up to that is the Ben Sorer Omora. Ben Sorer Omora, he's the rebellious son, the wayward and rebellious son. And when it comes to the Ben Sorer Omora and the Isha Sanua and Yifas Toar. Blessing. When the Chumash has this progression, and the Midrash, which Rashi cites, I think it's a Sifrei, but it's also a Tanchuma, that says that there's not just a progression in terms of the theme, but actually this can be a progression in real life. That if a person goes ahead and marries the Yifas Toar, which is halachically mutter, but as Rav Soloveitchik said, giving into the Yetzer Hara just because it's mutter isn't good, and therefore that leads to avera, and avera goreres avera. But what can happen is the practical the fallout of marrying Yifas Toar is that eventually you're going to come to hate her because you loved her for the wrong reasons anyway, and once she becomes ugly by the Torah procedure, which says that she has to make herself ugly essentially, she's going to be the hated wife. And then, who's going to be born from such a broken family? Bein Sorer Omora. So, section one is the dysfunctional family. Section number two, it contains, at least, again, this is my section number two. This is how I decided to divide it. Part of it incorporates the Parsha breakups. part of it, you know, it could be arbitrary. I could be completely wrong. And I would advise you to look at the Rishonim, look at the Rashis, look at the Ibn Ezra's, look at the Rashbams and Sfarnos that are available, even look at the Baal HaTurim, look at Rav Hirsch, see how they connect it. It's a long parsha. I wasn't able to look at the Mefarshim for all of them, but we try our best to see what jumps out at us from the Chumash as being a theme. So section two, I called it Respect of Fellow Creations. And section two has Tlia, death by hanging. Rashi connects it to the Bein Sora Amora, because the Bein Sora Amora is supposed to be hanged, but this doesn't directly relate to a dysfunctional family. But I think Tlia is the beginning of the topics of respect for fellow creations, because the next thing is Hashavas Aveda. You find an animal roaming around, you're supposed to return it. Part of respect for your fellow creations, whether it's a person or whether it's an animal, that you have to properly return something if you figure out who it belongs to. The reason why death by hanging would go here is that the Chumash doesn't just tell us that you're hanging a person. The Chumash says you can't hang them for too long because it's a disgrace, meaning the person's not even alive anymore. But apparently this is a disgrace to God for the person to be continue to be hanging there. So we have Tliya, we have Hashavas Aveda, we have Te'ina, which is to reload the animal, or hakama, of reloading the animal, that the animal is suffering under its load. Then we have Beged Ish and Beged Isha. So we have to talk about that. Why is that here? Then the final topic after that is Shiluach Hakan, or Shiluach Hakain. A grammatical point. You would say, you would only call it Shiluach Hakan because grammatically the word kan is a smichos, meaning it would be shiluach hakan tzipor. The mitzvah is called shiluach hakein. That means the sending of the nest, and shiluach hakan tzipor. So if you would connect kain with tzipor, it becomes kan tzipor. Although people abbreviate it and they call it shiluach hakan, really the mitzvah technically grammatically is shiluach hakein, or shiluach kan tzipor. So we can understand why Shiluach HaKan or Shiluach HaKain is connected to respective creations. Why is Beged Ish, Beged Isha in this section? If what I'm suggesting is true, that this section number two is about respective fellow creations, you could suggest maybe that by switching back and forth between the clothing that a man or a woman is supposed to be wearing, what they are in effect doing is they are lacking respect in the biology, the way Hashem created the world. Hashem created the world. He created men and he created women. He created them as one, and then he pulled them apart. And obviously, this is a touchy matter in 2019 with the modern culture. But fundamentally, the halacha hasn't changed in this regard, and that is that Hashem created, in the Bria, He created men and He created women. And in so doing, Hashem set a standard. And by men putting on women's clothes and women putting on men's clothes, it blurs those lines. And it's a lack of respect for Hashem's creation. So letting an animal suffer under its load, or having achzarias towards a mother bird, or letting a body hang, or letting an animal like just lie there. So all these things, and even men and women, switching clothes and allowing Hashem's creation to be insulted and mocked, so that all these things are lack of respect for creations. So number one is the dysfunctional family, and number two is the respect for fellow creations. From number 3, 4, and 5, for the next few sections, I have it under a new title called When Building a Home. And really, the dysfunctional family and respect, a lot of these things are all connected. But this comes to the theme that Rav Soloveitchik was talking about, which is building a family, building a home. And we'll see a lot of this in the next few sections. So number 3, when building a home, I have here, so Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that we have the pairing of house vineyard, right, a bias, a kerem, and a wife, an isha. We find this pairing in the on the Chozer Me'orche HaMalchama from last week's Parsha, the people who go home from war. So guess what? The people go home from war, and they go to their homes. And I said that Parshas Kisete is actually taking place after the war, so to speak, where you're actually going home and you're building the home. So it actually works out really nicely that we would find this set in Kisete, which in fact we do. So in building a home, that's actually where I put bias and kerem. I made wife a new section. So number three, we have bias and kerem, and I'm going to elaborate on what we find in there. Number four already is talking about a wife, because there are a lot of laws when it comes to the wife that I had to make wife its own section, even though wife is really a part of the building of a home. But laws of Ishos and laws of Nashim, all these things I made in section four. So again, section number one is dysfunctional family. Section number two is respect for fellow creations. Section number three is when building a home. Section four is going to be wife. But let's go back to section three for a second. What is in section three when building a home? So we start off with a bias. The Chumash says, "Ki sivne bias chadash." What do you need? You need a mica, you need or a ma'ake. You need a roof, a fence, or really a fence for your roof. And this way, people won't get hurt. Part of building a home is building a safe home. And building a safe home is not just building a home that's physically safe, but when you build a home, everybody knows that when you build a Jewish home, that home has to be a halachic home. That home has to be a home governed by Das Torah. It's not just that you have to; it has to be physically safe, it has to be spiritually safe. So therefore, although for reasons we don't understand, you're not allowed to have forbidden mixtures, when the Chumash tells us about a kerem, it says when you plant a kerem, you're not allowed to have forbidden mixtures. So now, under the subtitle of, or the subcategory of vineyard, of a kerem, we have for all the different kinds of forbidden mixtures. We have kilei ha-kerem, or we have kilei behema, that you shouldn't have an ox and a donkey threshing together or living together. That is obvious, that kind of interspecies relationship is a form of kilayim, it's a forbidden mixture. And shatnez, of course, kilei begadim. And in this section, they throw in tzitzis, and we have halachic reasons for that. Asei do chalos asei, that you can make tzitzis out of shatness. As long as you have all the halachic requirements for tzitzis, then tzitzis overrides shatness, and that's why it would go here. But all of this is under the subtitle of forbidden mixtures, which is under kerem. So we have bias, kerem, and then we move on to section four, which is wife. What do we have under the section of wife? A lot of things. We have motzi shemra. That's slandering or shaming the wife in Beis Din, saying that you didn't find psulim, even though and it was a lie, and there's a whole penalty for motzi shemra. Then the Chumash talks about, let's say she actually did commit adultery. Let's say she really wasn't a virgin when she consummated marriage with her husband. And she was an arusa. So the Chumash talks about znus, adultery, licentiousness. Then the Chumash talks about the Na'ara Hama'orasa, the betrothed maiden. What happens when she actually did engage in a relationship that she wasn't supposed to have a relationship with? Under Na'ara Hama'orasa, though, besides for this nus aspect, there are cases where she would not necessarily be liable for having done this nus, because we have under there the cases of Mefata and Ones. Mefata is seduction, Ones is rape. And we have the general halachos of mefata and ones, and how that pertains to all the different halachic ramifications of those cases. All of these are under wife. Now you can make the argument that section five also belongs under wife, but I made it a separate section. I called it forbidden unions because it's not merely about your own wife, but it's about people who are forbidden to you, people who cannot become your wife, or people who cannot become the husband of a good Jewish woman. So we have Eshes Av. In the section of Eshes Av, the Chumash also has a category called Kanaf Av. What's the Kanaf Av? The wing, or the canopy, the blanket of the Av. So that refers to, Rashi says it refers to the Shomer Es Yavam. Let me find the exact lashon that the Chumash uses to describe this figure, this person. But the point is, it's a person, the Kanaf Av. Oh, here it is. V'lo yigal kanaf Av. Shomeres Yavam, yeah, that's the lashon that Rashi uses. Meaning, what's a Shomeres Yavam? A woman who is anticipating Yibum by the person's father. So, in other words, if your father is waiting to do Yibum for a woman, that woman is off limits to you. That's the Kanaf Av. So, among the forbidden unions, we have the Eshes Av, we have Kanaf Av. The Chumash also says Pitsua Daka and Chrus Shofcha. The Pitsua Daka and Chrus Shofcha, these are two different examples of people who have crushed anatomy, or they have damaged anatomy in their reproductive organs. Those people, those men, are not allowed to marry into Kahal Yisrael. We also have Mamzer. We have Ammon and Moab. When the Chumash says you cannot marry Ammon and Moab, so this is where I mentioned weeks ago that Parshas Balak had to have been known to Klal Yisrael at some point, because Moshe Rabbeinu reports in Sefer Devarim that that Bilam tried to curse the Bnei Yisrael and Hashem thwarted it. So where do we know that that happened? Where in Devarim is that reported? It's reported right here. When Moshe says that a Moavi cannot marry into a Klal Yisrael, he quotes the story. He says, remember what Hashem had done by changing and flipping Bilam's curse. Haraya, that the people knew about it at some point. They at least knew about it well before Parshas Kisetse. Now, a mini section within the Forbidden Unions I refer to as benevolence toward brother nations. It's in the Forbidden Union section in section 5. But although you can't marry Ammon and Moab, there are two nations that at some point, after a couple of generations, so the Chumash allows you to marry into them, or that they can convert and marry in. One is Edom and one is Mitzrayim. Edom, the Chumash says, Edom is your brother. Mitzrayim, the Chumash says, that Mitzrayim, you know, despite all the bad that they've done, they did host you in their home. So that's more than we can say for Ammon and Moab, who did not allow Klal Yisrael to go in through the land, who did not give Klal Yisrael food to eat or water to drink. So all of that is the section of forbidden unions. So going back, number one is dysfunctional family. Number two is the case of respect for fellow creations, respect for Hashem's creations. Number three begins the subject of when building a home, talking about both a bias and a vineyard. Number four, we transitioned over to wife, all the halakos pertaining to wife. Then we have number five is forbidden unions. And number six, which is really related to both four and five, it's related to the wife rules, but it's not only that. I refer to it as campus purity / holiness. What goes under the category of campus purity and holiness? Well, first we have that the Chumash says the Chumash requires ritual and physical cleanliness in the camp. How ritual cleanliness? That if a person is tameh, they're supposed to leave the camp. If the person has an emission, they're supposed to go outside the camp. But not only that, there's physical cleanliness. The Chumash says that in the camp, you're actually supposed to have tools to clean up excrement. This is in the Chumash. You have to, that the camp is supposed to be physically clean. Not only that, the Chumash has an interesting halacha about what happens if there's a slave that ran free. It's unclear from Rashi, it's at least unclear from Pasha Pshat what kind of slave we're talking about. Rashi seems to suggest two possibilities: that it was a Kanani that was freed from a Jew, or a non-Jewish slave that was freed from a non-Jew. But the Chumash says you're not allowed to turn that freed slave over. Now, why is that a part of campus purity? We could suggest that part of campus purity and holiness is the affording of the opportunity for a slave to ultimately integrate into society, be like a human. And this is really connected to the next section, or the next subsection in campus purity, which is harlotry. The Chumash says, now I thought we spoke about znus already. What's the difference between harlotry and znus? So harlotry here, when it says lo siya kadesha b'Yisrael, there shouldn't be a kadesha nor a kadesh. You shouldn't have people who, even if they're not married, but they give themselves over for relations, almost like it's a business, to be an actual harlot, that violates campus purity. And turning over a freed slave or engaging in harlotry, both of those things are dehumanizing things. When you make a person like a slave, he's subhuman. When a person is a harlot, she's also subhuman. Now, what's really interesting is the last part of this section of campus purity is really the segue into section 7. The last part is Esnan Zona and Mechir Kelev. Esnan Zona refers to the harlot's wage, meaning money that's paid to a Zona. Or Mechir Kelev, that's when if you traded a dog for a sheep. You're not allowed to use Esnan Zona and Mechir Kelev for the Mizbeach, for Nedarim. So you can't fulfill a Neder with Esnan Zona or Mechir Kelev. It's disgusting. Part of campus purity is that we don't pay harlots for relations. It's just that's an impure thing to do. I don't think we need to elaborate on it. But section 7, which Esnan Zona is the introduction to, I refer to as forbidden exchanges / advantage of peers. What's under these forbidden exchanges? We have Esnan Zona and Mechir Kelev. But not only that, right after that, the Chumash talks about Neshech, interest. Interest is taking advantage of people, and that's an exchange you're not allowed to do. You cannot exchange one chesed of lending for extra money. That's not how it works. When someone lends money, it's not meant to be an exchange. You can't if it's a business deal, that's one thing. But if the person's doing a chesed, we don't pay people for chesed. So neshech, the interest aspect is a forbidden exchange. Next after that we have nedarim. So why is that related? So why are we discussing nedarim in the same section of forbidden exchanges and advantage of peers? The Chumash says that lo yachel devaro. That's not the exact lashon it uses here. That's the lashon that we find in Parshas Matos. But the Chumash says you have to keep your word. And if you don't keep your word, if you put off your neder, chil of a neder is the result it's taking advantage of Hashem. It's taking advantage of God. But not only that, if you think about Neshech and Neder, the relationship between them, Chilul Neder and Neshech are both the results of not repaying your dues on time. That's how you violate a Neder, by not fulfilling your Neder in time, and that's how you get paid interest. That's how you end up owing interest. Also in this section, we have Kerem and Kamas Reyecha. So what's Kerem and Kamas Reyecha? A person is supposed to allow their employees to take grapes and to eat the grains from the field. However, to pocket the grapes and to harvest the grains with a sickle, that is not okay. That, again, is taking monetary advantage, like ribbis, and it's like not fulfilling a neder. It's also a forbidden exchange. Because think about it, your employee is part of the exchange between you and your employee is that you have to give your employee the means to complete his work. That means if he's working in your field, he's allowed to eat a little bit. But he takes advantage of the system, and it's a forbidden exchange fundamentally when he is not merely taking the minimum amount of food that he's allowed to have for the work that he's doing, but he's taking extra. He's taking advantage. That's not a part of the exchange. That's a forbidden exchange. So under forbidden exchange, again, we have Esnan Zona, Mechir Kelev, we have Neshech, we have Nedarim, we have Kerem and Kamas Reyecha. These are things that are not okay. So up until section 7, and this is 7 out of Amir Hashem 9. So we're almost at the end, but we still have a lot to discuss. So section number 1, again, is dysfunctional family. Number 2 is respect to fellow creations. Number 3 is when building a home we have a bias and we have a kerem. Number 4 is all the halachos pertaining to a wife. Number 5 is forbidden unions. Number 6 is campus purity and holiness. Number 7 is forbidden exchanges and taking advantage of peers. Number 8, very interestingly, we have all the rules of divorce, of gittin, and right next to it we have shana rishona. So let's drop the anchor here for a second. Why is the topic of divorce and Shana Rishona, both which pertain to marriage, divorce being the opposite of marriage and Shana Rishona being the beginning of marriage? So we have the end of marriage and the beginning of marriage put right next to each other, and it's a little bit backwards. So we'll have to talk about that. Maybe Shana Rishona should have belonged in section 4. And maybe divorce should have belonged in section 4. In case of Motzi Shemra, in case of Onis and Mefata, and it would have made sense there thematically. So why are the rules of divorce and Shana Rishona not put back in section 4 with all the halachas pertaining to a wife? The simple answer, I would say, and this goes back to how we divide topics, that sections 4 through 7 really is one set. about the sanctity of the home and one's interpersonal relationships. And think about it, the halachos of the exchanges, those are campus purity. Those are all about how to deal with your peers, and not just your peers, but how to conduct yourself in the home. And all the halachos pertaining to the bias, the karem, and even your wife, those are all part of the Jewish home. This section of divorce is introducing the broke. It's not just the broken home. It's the home that ends. When divorce comes along, we're not talking about the house anymore, the karem. We're not talking about the wife. We're not talking like or the campus purity. All the interpersonal relationships. Divorce is the severing of a relationship, as opposed to these messy relationships or these inappropriate relationships that might exist, or relationships you're not allowed to have. Divorce is about a relationship that theoretically could have worked, but for whatever reason, unfortunately, or maybe it couldn't have worked, maybe it was mutter for it to have worked, but it just didn't work out, unfortunately, and therefore they had to get a divorce. But the point is, that is the ending of a Jewish home. Now, the question is why, another answer, by the way, as to why it's not, this was put here. So the Ibn Ezra and the Balat Zurim, they both point out the connection between Kicha Kicha Mizdei Ephron. We just finished talking about Kamas Reyacha and Karam Reyacha, about things that take place in someone's field. The Chumash says Ibn Ezra and Balat Zurim put the rules of divorce and Shana Rishona next to it, because really Shana Rishona is about a new marriage, so the connection to be made about Kicha Kicha Mistei Ephron was that's what they identify here. Something to point out is the irony that Shana Rishona is mentioned after the rules of divorce, when it could have been after the rules of marriage. It's ironic that they're even paired together at all. So why would that be? So Rashi points out that it's actually there's a halachic technical reason for this, and that is that when it talks about Shana Rishona, the rules of Shana Rishona, that a man can't go to war, so the Shana Rishona is telling us that it only works for Isha Chadasha, and Rashi says Prat L'Machzer Grushaso, meaning an Isha Chadasha refers to a brand new wife. Machzer Grushaso means an old wife. If you remarry an old wife, the rules of Shana Rishona do not apply. Now, V'simachas Ishto, the rule that you have to make your wife happy, so I believe the Mepharshim say that does not just apply during Shana Rishona. It has a stronger tokef, it has stronger ramifications during Shana Rishona, but the command to make your wife happy applies always. But the particular rule that sends you home from war, from all kinds, is only for Isha Chadasha. I would add another thing about the pairing. The one thing is that just because a divorce happens doesn't mean that a person's not supposed to get remarried. Lo tov heos adam levado, a man's not supposed to be alone. So another answer as to why Shana Rishona would be put after Gittin is to teach us that, no, you're supposed to get remarried. And it's you shouldn't accept being remaining by yourself, remaining alone. So there can be a new start after a finish. After one house is broken down, another house can be rebuilt. Or it can be newly built. Another thing, maybe, another connection you can suggest, coming from the standpoint of Musar, why would V'simachas Ishto be put right after V'shana Rishona? Why would that be put right after Gittin? And maybe the answer is to tell us that maybe a possible reason for the get in the first place. Why are they getting divorced? Why? And the Chumash talks about the possibility that the woman cheated on the man. And we can talk about why the woman cheated on her husband, or let's say they divorced for a different reason, nothing to do with cheating. But why did it happen? It could be because the man wasn't fulfilling his responsibilities of the V'simachas Ishto. And the Chumash puts it right next to each other, so you see why this thing might have happened. Either way, section number 8, we have divorce and Shana Rishona. And what's really interesting, in terms of Shana Rishona, the Ibn Ezra says Shana Rishona is really connected to the laws that follow. What are the laws that follow? So if you look at the Ibn Ezra by Shana Rishona, and then the next few halakos, the Ibn Ezra does a Parsha Power kind of a job, breaking down the connections between all of the mitzvos. And I think so Shana Rishona, you'll see in my notes, and I did this for a few things, like for Esnan Zona, for Shana Rishona as well, I put it in multiple sections because it's a segue point, it's a turning point. And so therefore, Shana Rishona is in section 8, but it's also in section 9. It's the beginning of what I refer to as social injustice and advantage of the weak. Before, we talk about taking advantage of your peers. Not just your peers, but your people who are above you in the relationship. But here, with this social injustice, we are looking at people who are weaker, people who are at a place of disadvantage. Shana Rishona is a part of this because the Ibn Ezra says you're not allowed to force the man to go to war. You have to allow, if his wife is in a vulnerable state, he has to be home with his wife now. The next section, right after that, the next subsection of social injustice and advantage of the weak, talks about the limitations on taking a pledge. You're not allowed to take a millstone or a grindstone. Now, I don't really know what these things are, but they pertain to eating. That people need these things to live, and since people need these things for sustenance, you can't take that as your pledge, as the pledge, and you can't go into the home and take the pledge. And someone might owe you money, and you might think that this is okay. It's not okay. You can't do that. We also talk about kidnapping in this section of social injustice and advantage of the weak. Who can be kidnapped other than someone who is weaker than the person who's kidnapping him? And the ultimate violation of a person, if not raping the person, would be kidnapping the person, and that's certainly the ultimate violation, taking advantage of someone else. In this section, we also have guarding Tsaras and remembering Miriam. Now, why would that be in this section? I would say that it's put in this section think about Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is another way of taking advantage of the weak or the unsuspecting by speaking about someone behind their back. By slandering someone, by speaking Lashon Hara, that is also taking advantage of someone who's in a vulnerable state because he's vulnerable because he doesn't know that you're talking about him and he can't defend himself. So that's all regarding Tsaras. Also in the section, we have halachas pertaining to the poor. Of course, the poor is the weak, the person you might take advantage of. And it talks about two cases of the poor person. You have the poor debtor, the person who owes money, or the poor laborer. And in these two sections, the Chumash tells us that a poor debtor, the debtor's security has to be returned to him by the time that he needs it. You can't take advantage of him and not return his security. You have to give his security back to him as soon as he needs it. And not only that, let's say he's a laborer. Let's say he's your employee. You have to pay him on time. Not paying him on time is taking advantage. In this section, too, we have vicarious punishment. Vicarious punishment meaning you're not allowed in court to punish someone for the sins of their father. The Chumash does talk about how Hashem visits the sins of the father upon the son, but the Mefarshim say very explicitly that Hashem only does that when the child repeats the sin of the father, and only Hashem can make such calculations, but a Beis Din cannot make such calculations. So we have vicarious punishment. Also, a bunch of halachos pertaining to the convert, the orphan, the widow, the ger, the asom, the almana. These are obviously people who are downtrodden. These are people who are lower on the food chain, on the totem pole, on the hierarchy, the social hierarchy. And you're not allowed to take advantage of them either. So the Chumash says, what about these people? What about these individuals? So it talks about perverting their justice, taking the garment of an almana as a pledge, off limits. And there's a good way to treat them, the Chumash says. Leave over your gleanings of the harvest for them. Shechacha, olel, peret. These are things that they're foods that that you're supposed to leave over for the ger, the asam, and the almana to take. Don't take advantage of them. In fact, leave things over for them. In here, we also have the rules of Malkos. Why are Malkos here? And why am I arguing that Malkos is in the section of taking advantage of the weak? So, if you look at the halacha of Malkos, the way it's presented in the Chumash says, Arbam Yakenu, and don't add Malkos to it. You cannot overdo the Malkos. And this will also explain why Malkos was not, you might think Malkos should be in Parsha Shoftim, which with all of the rules of court. Apparently it's here to teach us something else, that you might think you're in a place of power, that you're administering Malkos on a Russia, somebody who deserves Malkos, and I can therefore, I can be Makel, and I can overdo the Malkos. Absolutely not. That is off limits. That might be Ritzicha. If you killed him, you cannot overdo Malkos. And of course, we know the next to Malkos is Lo Sachsam Shar B'disho, the Lav de Chasima. We know that all the rules of Malkos are derived from the juxtaposition, the smichos with Lo Sachsam. Muzzling an ox in its threshing is also taking advantage of something that's weaker. Now, it's not physically weaker, but in terms of power, in terms of ownership, the ox is weaker. You have dominion over the ox. By muzzling it while it's threshing, it's unfair to the ox. The ox cognitively the ox cannot appreciate that he's not allowed to eat. You have to let the ox eat, and making it work and not allowing it to eat is torture. That's not okay. Yibam and chalitza I put in this section as well. Why? I put Yibam and Chalitza in this section because we're talking about another vulnerable party. Here, the vulnerable party is the man that died without kids. The brother is supposed to perpetuate his legacy. The wife is supposed to do her job in perpetuating the legacy. She's supposed to seek out the man, to marry the brother. But the Chumash talks about with Chalitza, what happens if the man doesn't want to do that? Ideally, the man should do Yibam, and if he doesn't, he's shamed in a process called Chalitza. And why? Because he's supposed to stand up for his late brother, his vulnerable late brother. And that's why I put Yibam and Chalitza here, continuing the theme of taking advantage of your underlings, which is really a repeat of a theme that we've seen in other parshiyos. I believe this came up in Mishpatim as well. So Ayin Shem for more on that. Also in the section of taking advantage of someone who's weaker, we have what I refer to as the violently overprotective wife. The Chumash has a very outlandish case where two men are in a fight, they're in a scuffle, they're roughhousing, and a woman, in an attempt to protect the husband, Chazal say that the man was not actually in danger, his life wasn't in danger. What did the woman do? She went overboard. She actually grabbed the private part of the other man, and she shamed him, and she might have damaged him, and the Chumash says Vikatosa es kapa, you have to cut off her hand. Chazal say it's not literal, but how does she take advantage of someone who's weaker? When you grab a man in his spot, in his vulnerable spot, that is clearly taking advantage of him. In that kind of way, he's weaker. The Chumash also in this section puts the issur of owning false weights and measures, because of course, someone just like Lashon Hara, someone's unsuspecting. When you have these false weights and measures, and they don't know that you're really cheating the system. So that almost takes us through the entire parsha, but there's one more section here. And that section is Parsha Zachor, Amalek, remembering Amalek. Now, before I got to the end of Parsha's Kisetze, and I was going through the sections, I was looking at the different topics, and I said, yeah, to me, these topics look like they're all about taking advantage of people or situations where people are weaker than you. So the question is, why cap everything off with Amalek? And I'll tell you what I think the answer is. Again, even before I took note of the fact that the Parsha ends with Amalek, I noticed the theme of taking advantage of the weak. Look at Amalek, look at the Parsha of Amalek. The Parsha of Amalek talks about how Amalek attacked, the story, when you were ayef v'ageya, you were weak and you were vulnerable. That is the essence of Amalek. You want to know what Amalek is? The essence of Amalek is taking advantage of weaker parties, taking advantage of the vulnerable. And who can do that? Only someone who is v'lo yirei Elokim. Someone who does not fear God, who's not afraid of owning false weights and measures. He's not afraid of speaking Lashon Hara. He's not afraid of taking advantage of people who are weaker than him, or animals who are weaker than him, or situations, or people who are dead and cannot perpetuate their own name. Taking advantage of other people, that comes from someone who's not a Yarei Shemayim. Because he's not afraid of Hashem, he's only afraid of people. Since he's afraid of people, you know, like the Ghana versus the Goslin. The Goslin, he's afraid of people, he's afraid of Hashem. The Goslin is not afraid of anybody. So he's pretty brazen, but at least, you know, he doesn't treat Hashem differently than he treats other people. When it comes to the Ganav is afraid of people, that's why he goes in the night, but he's afraid of Hashem. Sorry, he's not afraid of Hashem, because he knows that Hashem is watching and he does it anyway. So that's a v'lo yirei Elokim, that's taking advantage of the weak. And that's a powerful way to cap off Parshas Kisetze. So Parshas Kisetze starts off talking about love, beauty of the Jewish home, and how you're not supposed to love an Eishes Yifas Tohar. You're not supposed to have two wives, one that you love and then one that you hate. You're not supposed to be building broken homes. And Motzi Shemra, loving relationship requires certain purity. There's certain people that you're allowed to love, certain people that you're not allowed to love. And, you know, and some people might feel bad about that. But no, Chumash, the Torah governs our entire lives. From Ahava to Yira, it commands us to love Hashem. It commands us to direct our emotions in a certain direction. That's the first half. But then after, when we're talking about not violating the sacred relationships in our life and not making light of those relationships. For example, the forbidden exchanges and taking advantage of our peers, there comes another section where it doesn't come from a matter of who you love and who you don't love, but it's a matter of who you fear and who you don't fear. The whole final section of the Chumash says, okay, there are relationships that are supposed to be sacred. There are people that you're supposed to love, people that you're not supposed to love, people that you're supposed to be loyal to, and people that you don't owe any loyalty to. That's all about Ahava. But then we look at the people who, you know, you may love them, you may not love them, but the reason why you take advantage of them is because you don't fear Hashem. And that's not okay. And therefore, your life has to be governed by both Ahava and Yira. The whole latter section, that whole final section of taking advantage of the week, pertains to the theme of not having Yiras Shemayim, not fearing Hashem, and that's why Amalek is the end of that topic. You want to wipe out the memory of Amalek, then don't take advantage of people who are weaker than you. Don't take advantage of the vulnerable. So with that, we actually, Baruch Hashem, get through Parshas Kisei Tse, a very long Parsha. I'm surprised that we did it in under 50 minutes. But just to wrap up the topic again, number one, we have the dysfunctional family, Vas Toar, the two wives, Ruf Pishnayim, and Ben Sora Mora. Number two, we have respective fellow creations, which includes Tlia, hanging, Hashavas Aveda, Teina, reloading the animal, Begirish and Begirisha, which again is respecting Hashem's creations, Shiluach HaKain. Number three, we have building a home, which involves building a house with a mica, a roof, a vineyard, forbidden mixtures, kile kerem, kile behema, shatnas, tzitzis. Then number four, we have all the halakhas of wife, from motzi shem, from znus, from nara, hamarasa, ma'onis, mafata. Number five, we have forbidden unions, from eshes av to kenaf av, pitzuadaka, chros shofcha, mamzer, amon, moav, and of course the benevolence that you have to have towards Edom and Mitzrayim, our brother nations. More cousin nations. Number six, we have campus purity and holiness, whether ritual and physical cleanliness in the camp. Two, not dehumanizing a freed slave and not engaging in harlotry. And of course, which segues into the Esnan Zona Mechir Kelev, where we talk about forbidden exchanges and how to take advantage of your peers and not just, again, not just your peers, but people who are above, or parties who are above you. So we have Esnan Zona Mechir Kelev, we have Neshech, we have Nedarim, we have Kerem and Kamas Reecha, which segues into number eight, the rules of divorce and Shana Rishona. And Shana Rishona, we said, is really a part of the social injustice and taking advantage of the vulnerable in the weak, which is section number nine. And in that section, again, we have Shana Rishona, we have the pledge limitations, no, you can't take a millstone as a pledge. We have kidnapping, Tsaras and Lashon Hara, the poor, vicarious punishment, how to treat the ger, the yasam, and the almana, the convert, the orphan, and the widow, the rules of Malkos, that you can't overdo them just because the guy is a Rasha, just because the guy is vulnerable and in the courtroom, muzzling an ox while it's threshing, yubim and chalitza, not taking advantage of the dead, and of course not taking advantage of a man's vulnerable place of his body, the violently overprotective woman, not taking advantage of people who are unsuspecting of your false weights and measures. And of course, Amalek, not taking advantage of people who are more vulnerable than you, not taking advantage of the weak. We want to wipe out Amalek. We're not going to do that. We have to have relationships that are focused on proper Ahava and Yira. And Demir Tashem, we will pick up next time with Parshas Kisavo, which will actually mark the first anniversary of Parsha Power. Parshas Kisavo was our first Chabura. I no longer have the recording for that. I don't think the recording is available. And as far as I know, we're going to continue Parsha Power to the best of our abilities, and we'll uncover more on the Parsha. But Baruch Hashem, we have an incredible Parsha. We've taken it through Parshas Kisei Tse. Everyone, have a wonderful Shabbos.